Okay. So now we finally move to the answer of the Gemara. Yeah. Now, as we have done every day, let us recap so we remember where we are in this Yerushalmi. Okay. By the end of this, if you do not know this Yerushalmi, like, you know, basically by heart. Okay. So again, Yerushalmi starts off by introducing a pasuk, which pasuk is unclear, for Tosefet Shvi'i. Then, later on in the Gemara, it says, at some point, they voted it out of existence, right? And then they say, how could you vote out of existence? You can't vote something out of existence unless you're God Almin of Chachma Uvimimim. Yes? Good. Everyone's with me, I hope. Good. So, as we noted, some of the classical Mepharshim on the Yerushalmi, like the Pnei Moshe. Who? Josh, what are their tendencies? Two? Well, A, they changed the pasuk. Why do they do that? Because
they want to squish the...
Thank you. They want to squish the very formal language that they want to squish. It's like, we'll write up this sugya as an article, right? To explain that Pnei Moshe, who will squish, that's right, he squishes the Babli and the Yerushalmi together, and therefore, James the Buster. What's his problem is if you squish the Babli and the Yerushalmi together. So, you start off by assuming it's biblical, which makes you think that you're talking about Rabbi Akiva. However, we then transition to a discussion that is found in the Babli in the context of Rabbi Shmuel, right? And additional problem, which is if you understand, like the Rambam, that the limitations of Chochma Aminyan, the requirements that wider consensus and greater expertise are limited to rabbinic law, then it seems like without telling us, we've transitioned into Rabbi Shmuel. And in fact, that's how the Bnei Moshe understands it. We begin the discussion with Rabbi Akiva, and then the Gemara transitions into assuming we're talking within the context of Rabbi Shmuel. Right? Good. Then we spend 2 days proving that this doesn't need to be the case. Because we said, if you do not take the assumption that the Babli must be understood in light of the Yerushalmi, therefore the fact that the Yerushalmi opens with a pasuk leaves you free to believe that from beginning to end, what does the Yerushalmi assume the nature of the Tosefet Shvi'i is? It is, right, it is Doraita. Right, that's all I needed for a moment. If it's Doraita, then why are suddenly we asking similar questions to the Yerushalmi? Because, sorry, did Babli ask in the context of Yishmael? Because, yes, the Yerushalmi represents a different tradition in this sugya, which is not identical to the presentation neither of Rabbi Akiva nor of Yishmael as we have it in the Babli. In order to get to that point, we needed to say, okay, but if that's the case, then how can we be functioning on the level of Doraita and nevertheless reach the point where the Gemara says, but you aren't allowed to vote it out of existence unless you're Gadol Menu B'Chacham Minyan? Isn't that limitation only in the Derabbanan? And we said, no, if you reject the Rambam, then that's not necessarily the case. And we gave 2 examples of physicians who believe that the limitations of Chacham Minyan either apply to all or at least sometimes to Doraita. The Melechet Shlomo, who said that seemingly even by Doraita, you need Chachma Aminyan whenever you want to uproot a previous law rather than just temporarily rely on a minority position. And that's how he understood the Mishnah. And Rav Kook says it is true in general, the Rambam is correct, that only rabbinic law has the limitations of Chachma Aminyan. Biblical reinterpretation does not. However, he says there's an exception, and that is, and that was a biblical interpretation that was offered unanimously. And if it was offered unanimously, then you can uproot it, but in such a case, you can only uproot it if you're God of Men of Chacham Aminyan. There are other positions, but what you see from both Melechet Shlomo and Rav Kook is that at least under some circumstances, the problem of changing a previous decision, even that of biblical interpretation, can be constrained by God of Men of Chacham Aminyan, which allows us to assume that the Yerushalmi, even at this stage, is continuing to function on the level that Tosefet Shvi'i, if it exists, is biblical. Yes? Good, good 4-minute summary of what we've seen, how we've gotten here. And now the Gemara finally answers this question. And what's the Gemara's answer? So the Gemara, let's just read it first. The Gemara says, Rebbe Acha B'Shem, sorry. Let's get up to this point, right? So what does the Gemara say? Rebbe Kurzboi Rishem Rebbe Yochanan She'im Bikesh Lachrosh Yachroshu, right? When they voted it out, they voted that if you want to apply, you can. that. If you want to plow, you can. So then the words of the Akru Otam Min HaMishnah. So if that's the case, why don't you remove it entirely from the Mishnah? Right? So what's the answer? She'im Bikshu Lachzor Yachzoru. So if they want to make it prohibited again, they can make it prohibited again. Now, at this stage, are we dealing on the level of Doraita or dealing with the level of Derabanan? Well, it's not clear. Meaning, the easiest way to read this is admittedly that it is Derabanan. Why? Because it's saying if you want to bring it back, you bring it back. You want to get rid of it, you can get rid of it. However, does it necessarily at this stage mean that it's Derabanan? No, why not? Because as we've already seen, if you think that the constraints of voting apply even to Doraita, and as we saw, for example, in Rav Kook and in Halachat Shlomo in different ways, the existence of minority positions, even the level of Doraita, is relevant. So therefore, it might not mean here that if they want to, meaning some, they feel like it, they can prohibit it. And if they feel like it, they can permit it, which sounds very much Derabanan. And what might it mean? That if they choose to, maybe according to Halachat Shlomo, if they choose to temporarily suspend it or bring it back, they can, because B'shat HaTzchak, you always have the ability to rely on minority positions, and therefore you leave them in the Mishnah, such that you have the ability, if necessary, to rely on them. Or, according to Rav Kook, right, it's important to tell you that it's a minority position, such that you don't have the constraints of Chachma Minyan on a Doraita, right? Because according to Rav Kook, if it was unanimous, then you would need, and it's Doraita, you would still need Chachma Minyan to reinterpret the Torah, right? But if it wasn't unanimous, would you need Chacham of a Minyan to? No. So both according to Rav Kook and according to Halachat Shlomo, you could read the continuation of the Gemara as saying that Tosefet Shviit is Doraita. When it says that if you want to revert, it doesn't mean if you want to, like capriciously, you choose to. Right? It means that you'll have the legal authority to do that because of it's only a Shat HaTzchak, because it's not a unanimous reinterpretation. Right, so from the Torah, from the Mishnah, well, it's actually Machlok Mefarshim, which, you know, there's only so much that I can get you into. But yes, some say that Min HaMishnah means Min HaTorah. If it doesn't exist, get rid of it. Others say it means literally just from the Mishnah. Stop talking about Tosefet Shviit. So let's assume for the moment to the Mishnah. I mean, from that which we learn, right? Mishnah is, right? Vishinan tam levanecha, you shall teach your children, right? I mean, that language can also just mean Torah studies. I mean, stop learning it, right? Stop talking about it. It doesn't mean cut out the psukim. It doesn't mean cut out the psukim. Yeah, look, if you look at the footnote from the art scroll, they'll tell you different ways of understanding it, but there's only so much we can do with the halacha. Right? So then the Gemara says, wait a second, Hatu Rabbi Yona, Hare Parshat Hamiluim, Hare Parshat Dor HaMabul, Hare Einan Atidit Lachzor. He said, wait a second, what is your assumption? That we only leave things in the Torah or the Mishnah, whatever you think this is, if there is potential future relevance? Is that true? No, because the story of the Mabul is also, and again, is it in the Torah or in the Mishnah? You could read this as saying, it is in the Torah, which shows you that the Torah cares about history and not just future relevance. Or you could say it literally means in the Mishnah because it's mentioned in the Mishnah. Which Mishnah? In Perek Chelek, right, where it talks about the people of Chelek and Olam Haba, right? So it might mean that. Again, I don't want to get too bogged down in the question of whether it literally means here, Mishnah. And what it's saying is that the Mishnah has historical relics, or if it means that Torah in general is legitimate to have historical relics, not in, like, an irrelevant relic, but meaning that it's not relevant actively in the future. Correct. Right, and guys, if you're more interested in this, I don't want to spend too much time in it, but if you look here in footnote 11, remember I told you, whenever you have a girsah, you can always look at the art scroll. In footnote 11 here, they tell you the Ramban's girsah here is the Torah. Right, so there are different girsah owed here. So he says, that's not a proof. You're right, sometimes you have things which are historical relics, and why are they in the Mishnah or the Torah, whatever you think the Gear says here? Why are they there if it's only history? To tell you that they happened, right? Meaning the Gemara is saying, don't get too worked up about it. Sometimes there are things in the Torah or the Mishnah that are not, in fact, active in the future, but are important because it's important to know history. Yeah? Good. But none of...
What about the models?
What? The Mishnah in the end of Sanhedrin talked about whether the Anshei Dor HaMa will have a Chelek in Olam Haba. So there is a discussion of it in the Mishnah, and that's why both options are available. But then the Gemara has, as I bolded here, the most shocking of the answers, right? Until now, nothing here is such a shocking answer, right? Meaning, until now it's saying, listen, whatever, we can work it out whether you think it's Darabanan or it's Daraita, right? The question is, if you got rid of it, why are you still mentioning it in the Mishnah, right? So the immediate previous answer is, because sometimes we mention things that are just historical information, right? Does that change anything analytically about what we understand in the nature of Tosefta Shviit? Nothing, right? It's an interesting question as to whether the Mishnah or the Torah is meant to mention historical things that are not practically relevant, but...
It also sounds like from this answer that in the future we can't go back.
Correct. According to the second answer, it sounds like either it's impossible in the future that we'll have Tosefta Shviit again, or it's unlikely, or that's not the Mishnah's point, or whatever.
But if it can't happen, then that means that
Correct. If you want it to be very fancy, you could say, aha, it's only a historical relic because this one was unanimous, it was basically impossible for it ever to be uprooted. Right? And if it is, even if it is, the minority position becomes irrelevant at that point. Correct. Right? You could be very fancy and read or cook into it. That was the second answer. The first answer was simply,
yeah.
Right? No, if they want to revert, they can. What does that mean? Well, according to the Darabana, right, again, based on all the positions we saw, if you hold like Menachem Shlomo, it means that they can rely on the minority position. According to Rav Kook, it means that they can overturn it without Gadol Men of Chacham Aminyan. If you think it's Darabanan, it would be weird, because if it's Darabanan, what you would say is maybe this is an exception to the normal rule. They normally need Gadol Men of Chacham Aminyan, but specifically in the context of Tosefta Shviit, the rabbis
built in a
clause that you don't need Chacham Aminyan to uproot. Okay, all that is very interesting. But the most shocking is the third answer. And that's what I want to focus on. Not the third answer, but the fourth stage in it. The next line in the Gemara is, Amar Eimana, Kaidis Anin Taman, Shem Yomar Adam, Kachanin Mikubal, Yomru lo kedibrei Rebbe Ishploni Shamata, V'kein Shem Yomar Adam Shamati Shasur Lachoshad Rashana Yomru Beisr Shnei Prakim Arishonim Shamata. The third answer in the Gemara is, why do we mention Tosefta Shviit? So that if someone says, I heard that Tosefta Shviit is Usur, what can you tell him? You're right, but that was what it used to be. It's not true anymore. Who is that according to?
The
Mishnah Idiot. Whose position in the Mishnah Idiot?
Rabbi
Yehuda's position, right? That the point of mentioning minority positions is so that you can absolutely reject them. Right? Right?
Yeah, can you connect it to the extension?
Correct. Yeah. You could say that the benefit of it, right, you could say there's a modification of the second answer, which is we care about history not just because we care about history, we care about history because it prevents you from going down that path again. Again, does that tell you that it's Daraita or Darabanan? No. According to the Rambam, what does it tell you? That it's Darabanan because he thinks that those Mishnayot are functioning on the level of Darabanan, right? But according to everybody else, as we've talked about, not necessarily because we're true in Daraita, right?
But it's just saying that there's a minority opinion, but it's wrong. It kind of like that.
No, but again, that may be true, but it doesn't tell us whether it's Daraita or Darabanan.
Yeah.
Right? That depends on everything we've seen, right?
Okay,
good. So let's summarize what we've seen so far. Right? The Gemara says, okay, if the Tosefta Shviit doesn't apply anymore, why is it still mentioned in the Mishnah? Right? And again, our goal here is to figure out whether this tells us Daraita Darabanan, what its nature is. Okay? We have three possibilities. The first one is, if they want to, they can change their minds. What does that mean? Is it Daraita Darabanan? So options. Either it's Darabanan, and what the Gemara is telling you is that uniquely by Tosefta Shviit, we built in a clause that you can uproot it if you want. Right? And that's why we still mention the Mishnah. Correct? everything is d'oraita, so then we have several possibilities. According to Melechet Shlomo, you could say, well, it's important for you to know the minority position because it gives you more flexibility, such as in cases of Shadat Chak. Right? Not necessarily the most plausible read here, but okay, theoretically possible. According to Rav Kook, it could be d'oraita, and it has to tell you that it wasn't unanimous, because if it was unanimous, it would be much harder to uproot it. Right? Fine. Second answer is, no, we mentioned it in the Mishnah as a historical piece of information. Right? That's it. Within that, do we know whether this shita holds its d'oraita d'rabbanan? No, it could be either it's d'rabbanan and we mentioned the history that at some point we forbade it and then we came to permit it, or it's d'oraita and we used to understand the Torah as saying it was usur, and now we tell you it's not, right? Third possibility is that we mention it for the same reason that Rabbi Yehuda in the Mishnah Adio thinks you mentioned positions, which is to make sure that you never go back to it. Again, d'oraita, d'rabbanan, don't know. Depends how you read the Mishnah and Adio, which as we saw, the Rambam tends to read the Mishnah and Adio that's dealing with the Rabbanan, right? At least part of it, maybe not all of it. But Melechet Shlomo Rav Kook clearly holds that it's also talking about d'oraita. So until that point, right, we have no idea. Then the Gemara offers a fourth answer, or a fourth explanation of how we get here, which is Amar Rav Acha, there's no Amar, but it's implied, B'shem Rav Yonatan. When they forbade it, they hung their hat on a pasuk. And when they permitted it, they hung their hat on a pasuk. When they forbade it, they relied on a pasuk. Which pasuk? They forbade it based on the drasha that we've already seen, right? And when they permitted it, they relied on a pasuk again. As you will see in the as earlier, there are also several options for the pasuk here. Right? So I'm just going to read the one as it appears in the R scroll, but you can, if you would like, you can, and maybe at the end we'll see what it matters, which pasuk is derived from. But sheish yamim ta'avod v'asita kol melachtecha ma'erev shabbat reishit at mutar lasot melacha ashet tishkach chama ach erev shabtot shanim at mutar lasot melacha ashet tishkach chama. We compare it to Shabbat, and on Shabbat you're allowed to do melacha all the way until sunset. Now, who does this sound like? Well, first of all, who does this sound like? More or less? No, not Rabbi Akiva. No. This line. What? Not Rabbi Shmuel, not Rabbi Akiva. Who does it sound like? Rabbi Yochanan. Remember Rabbi Yochanan the Bavli, who said there's no Tosefet Shviit because we compare it to Shabbat, and Shabbat is no Tosefet Shabbat? Right? This sounds, right? If you know the Bavli, it sounds like what's going on here. The Gemara is moving on from Rabbi Ishmael or Rabbi Akiva and going to Rabbi Yochanan, right?
The first part of that answer sounds like Rabbi Akiva.
Yes, meaning we used to think, that was exactly what Rabbi Yochanan said, we used to think like Rabbi Akiva, and then we came up with a different drasha, which permitted it. The first half, correct. The first half is clearly sounds like Rabbi Ishmael, but the rejection sounds exactly like Rabbi Yochanan's rejection of Rabbi Akiva in the Bavli, right? Which is, we used to think there was Tosefet Shviit, but then we found a different pasuk if we compared it to Shabbat. And all the questions we asked on in the Bavli, which is, how can you say there's no such thing as Tosefet Shabbat? There is such a thing as Tosefet Shabbat. And there was all the answers we saw there. Remember, there was Mordechai's answer, which was, they're fundamentally different, which is from the vantage point of Shabbat, you're allowed to keep, you don't have to keep an Isra Malacha until Shabbat, but we want to show honor, so it's not really an Isra Malacha, it's something else. Or the Tosfot Rush, which was, you only add to Shabbat to prevent suffix, to prevent accidentally violating Shabbat, right? Or the conceptual difference, which is, Tosefet Shviit is about preparation, Tosefet Shabbat is about Tosefet Kedusha, and therefore they're not comparable, right? We did all of that in the Bavli. What is the problem here in the Yerushalmi? Right, what's the problem here in the Yerushalmi? The big problem in the Yerushalmi to get a clear answer on what the heck we're talking about is the word samchu. Now, why is samchu a problem? Why does samchu create so much headache in understanding the Rishonim? Because what? Because normally in the Bavli, what does the word samchu almost always mean? Asmachta. And what is not asmachta? According to Moshe, usually it means a derabanan. And the pasuk is asmachta ba'alma. It's just a hint of something, right? What's the problem? If that's the case, what have we transitioned to clearly? Derabanan, but even derabanan in the context of who?
Rabbi Akiva.
Right? When we forbade it, b'charizu katir tishvot, we relied on a pasuk with an asmachta. And when we permitted asmachta, if you read it the way you would normally read it in the Bavli, what would we end up with? A very weird claim, which is, not only is Rabbi Shmuel think that some of it is derabanan, but Rabbi Akiva, who until now we assumed kedavar pashut, because he quotes the pasuk is d'oraita. Well, one second, right? Well, right, if you read it the way a normal person, the Bavli, would read it, what would that suddenly conclude? That even according to Rabbi Akiva, what is Tosefet Shvi'it? Dirabanan! Oh, everything we know about this sugya is garbage! Ah, goodbye! The whole thing, it makes no sense, yalla! What? What? Potentially, that's what those words could mean, right? Right? Now, what that would be a shocking, shocking... Okay, wait one second. So Kobe says, I don't buy that. That's crazy talk, right? Stop being such a Bavli Jew. This isn't even a Bavli conceptual thing. This is just what words do you use in the Yerushalmi? He says, not be dumb. Right, Kobe says, if I want to rephrase Kobe, Kobe's like, whoa. I mean, I get it. In the Bavli, the word asmachta normally means a derabanan, and the pasuk isn't a real drasha. But, come on! Maybe in Palestinian, Talmudic, Judeo-Aramaic, the word samchu means something else.
Samchu always means reliable. You can't use that to interpret or learn.
What could it mean? So Kobe says maybe it literally means they darshan this. They darshan it, meaning samchu doesn't mean it's derabanan. Samchu means. Whoa. So Josh says it's impossible. But before we attack Josh, before we attack Kobe, let's know that Kobe is in good company. Kobe is in good company. Who is Kobe Machavidu? Right? Who is Kobe Machavin to? Who says exactly what Kobe says? No. I gave it to you, but I don't know if you got to it. Where did I put it? I'm really losing my mind. Where did I put it? My Rucham Kaniyevsky, where did I put it? Oh, I'm really losing my mind. It's open in front of me. That's why I don't know where it is. Yeah, so Rucham Kaniyevsky says exactly what Kobe says. Now, who is Rucham Kaniyevsky? So if you open any Haredi newspaper today, he has a very nice title. What is his title? What? Oh, well, Chaim is great, but before that he gets this nice thing. In the last few years he's been getting this very nice introduction, which is the Sar HaTorah. Yes, the Sar HaTorah. He is the, right, Gadol Hador. Okay, Chaim Kaniyevsky is no small posek. He is a very, very, very impressive figure. Whether you like everything he says is not the point. Reb Chaim Kaniyevsky is a mind-boggling Talmud Chacham. I mean, it really, I mean, like, there are certain Talmud Chachamim, as one of my Rebbeim once said, there are different types of Talmud Chachamim, right? There are Talmud Chachamim that are, it's clear that they're smart and they worked hard for many years, right? And you look at them and you're like, listen, maybe if I had their hasmad and I learned, you know, for many years, like, when I'm their age, whatever his age is, like 99 or something, I don't know, 105, I don't know. He's very old. I don't even know how old he is anymore. You'd say, yeah, I could do that. And then there are certain people you look at it and it's like, I don't get it. I have no idea how you do what you do. So if I'm getting asked, he's one of those people. Whenever I read him, I'm like, I don't know what you want for my life. I mean, I give up. Right? Like, the piece we're going to look at, so he has a commentary. He basically wrote a Mishnah Berurah style commentary using the Rambam as his base on Zraim, Kachim, and Tarot, like all the parts of Torah that no one else uses, like no one else understands, which is excellent, called Derech Emunah. And then on Shvi'it, they happen to take everything in Derech Emunah plus all of the Chaim Ganievsky's other books and ordered it all Seder HaMishnah. So this piece is actually not from Derech Emunah, it's actually from Nachal Eitan. Nachal Eitan is one of those books that when I first read it made me feel ridiculously inferior and made me want to sort of give up on Torah forever because it's impossible. It's like this 400-page monstrosity, which Chaim Ganievsky wrote when he was like 20 years old or something, on the mitzvah of Egla Arufa. Okay, it's like, I just don't understand how you do something like that. When you're 20, right? It's like, let's take a... I did not do that when I was 20, right? That was what, you know, Yaakov Vard, my book on Rav Ovadia. And the first chapter, which talks about his biography, is also one of those things. We're like, really? You wrote your first book at 9? That's great. I default. Right? Oh, you were the post-ache of the entire country at 18 and going against the Venish Chai. That's just great. Thanks. That's wonderful. Wonderful. That's what we all did. When he was 9. Yes. Look, it was like, when I was in Shranahalev Shanabet, the yeshiva, someone had this brilliant idea that they should have Rav Lichtenstein talk to us about his life. Because it's important to see that Gedolim are people too. It was fascinating, but it did not accomplish its goal, right? It just didn't, because Rav was like telling us about his biography. And he was like, well, when I was a kid, my parents really encouraged me to learn, and they used to give me, it was like, I forget what it was, like a dime for every Sefer of Tanakh that I did, and a quarter for every like Sefer Mishnayot or whatever it is, right? So, okay, I mean, that's very nice, right? Like, we make a cake for our kids when they finish whatever. He's like, so I finished Tanakh when I was 7, and I was like, oh, did you? And finished Mishnah, and then I think he read all of Greek Jewish history when he was 7 or something like this. So I was like, oh, really? Okay. Yeah, I did that too. Yeah. Okay. Anyway, Rav Chaim Ganievsky and Nachal Eitan says exactly, the Sar HaTorah says exactly what Kobe says, or Kobe says what the Sar HaTorah says. What? Yeah, exactly. So what does he write? So if you have it, he writes, Nachal Eitan, Dana in Lashon Samchu, Chachamin Mikol Mekrahu Drashag Murara Asmach Lema'alme. He goes through the question in all of the Torah. Whenever it says Samchu, does it always mean Asmachter? Does it sometimes mean, no, we're real Drasha? V'katav d'lecha'ora matinu v'zeh stirot. And he says, there seems to be a stiro. Why? D'hinei b'Yerushalmi reish shvi'it ka'amar gavei shnei prakim ha'rishonim rach v'shem Rav Yonatan b'shah shasru. By the way, a very easy Gersa mistake here could be Yonatan v'Yochanan. Right? Meaning, since in the Bavli we know that this is the name of Rav Yochanan, it could easily be Rav Yonatan. Right? That's a very easy mistake to make. Right? Very easy textual error. But he says, Bishah Shastru the Mikra Samchu, Bishah Shatiru the Mikra Samchu, Bishah Shastru the Mikra Samchu, Bikharish of Kajiswo, Bishah Shatiru the Mikra Samchu, Shizim Tavod. Ma Erev Shabbat, Rechid at Mutar Lazon Melachat, Tishka Chama, Uvaze Yeshli Stapek. So now he says, in our Yerushalmi, it's unclear. Im Kavana Yerushalmi, Derabi Natan, Sphere Ledu Drasha, Gimura. It could be exactly what Kobe said, that what's going on here is that it was the Araita. To be Shashru Darshua Pasuk Bekharishu Vekatir Litosefet Shvi'it Minatorav Akhakhish Rangamliel Bitel Matama Mikracher Lidrosh Minatora Mutar. Wait a second, Kobe, I need you. Ah, Kobe. Vlachain Bitel and got rid of it. Ki did the Gemara Moed Katan. Just like who? In the Bavli, Rabbi Yochanan, that Rabbi Gamliel Beidino Mida writes a batlu my time gamar Shabbat Preshit, mi Shabbat Preshit. Right? So he says, what is a very plausible way of reading Yerushalmi? If you think that the word samchu doesn't mean samchu here, what does it mean? In Bavli language, what would we have called it? Darshu. Then he says, what is the Yerushalmi doing? The Yerushalmi is the same as Kobe. Rabbi Yochanan, which is not crazy, because here it says Rabbi Yonatan, and Rabbi Yonatan and Rabbi Yochanan are easily switched, right? And therefore, and now, Kobe, why does this answer the question? Now, why are we doing this again? Why does this answer, remember, go back. What was the question? How can you uproot Tosefet Shvi'it? You need to be Gadol Mimenu V'Chachma Uv'Minyan. Right? Well, think about the Rambam. What does the Rambam say? That only applies to Dirabanan. But if it's all right, then you're arguing on how to read the Torah, then you don't need the Gadol Mimenu V'Chachma Uv'Minyan. So how do you read the Yerushalmi according to this answer, according to Kobe? The Gemara started off by saying it's D'oraita, and then it said, but they got rid of it, and they said, how do you get rid of it? You can't Gadol Mimenu V'Chachma Uv'Minyan. Why would that be a problem? Only if you thought we transitioned to think it's D'rabbanan. What's the Gemara's answer? No, you misunderstand what's going on. It wasn't that they uprooted Gzeira, it was that originally they understood the Torah like Rabbi Akiva, and later they understood the Torah like Rabbi Yochanan and the Bavli, right? That there's no Tosefet Shvi'it. And what's the rule according to the Rambam? If your machloket with a previous Beit Din is not about a Dirabanan, but is about biblical interpretation, do you need Gadol Mimenu V'Chachma Uv'Minyan? No! So how would you read Yerushalmi? The question was, wait a second, they got rid of it. Doesn't that prove it's Dirabanan? Answer, no, you don't understand. We didn't mean they got rid of Dirabanan, which would have required Chachma Uv'Minyan. What did you need? What did they do? They voted to reinterpret the Torah. And if you vote to reinterpret the Torah according to the Rambam, then you don't need Chachma Uv'Minyan. And that was the question and answer. So the question and the fourth answer of the Gemara is saying, you thought we transitioned to think it was Dirabanan, which requires to have Gadol Mimenu V'Chachma Uv'Minyan, you're wrong. What we did was we understood the Torah differently, and we were arguing on biblical interpretation that doesn't require greater numbers. So again, maybe Rabbi Ishmael is in the back of their mind, whatever, right? But Ruchaim Kanievsky says exactly what Kobe said, is no. All you got to do is recognize the word samchu doesn't necessarily mean derabanan. It sometimes, at least in Yerushalmi Hebrew, means darshu. And what it's saying is the reason that we have no limitation with Chachma Uv'Minyan is because at first they forbade it based on one interpretation of the Torah, and they later interpreted the Torah like Rabbi Yochanan. Right? They started by interpreting it like Rabbi Akiva, that there's a drasha that says Tosefet Shvi'it is Asur, and then they learned like Rabbi Yochanan. We compared it to Shabbat, as we just talked about with Mordechai, that there's no Tosefet Shvi'it, whatever that means, right? Sorry, just like there's no Tosefet Shabbat, the fact that there is Tosefet Shabbat, bracket that, right? And that's why we didn't need Chachma Uv'Minyan, because it was just, we had a machloket, they had to understand the Torah. Now we popped in like what we call in the Bavli Rabbi Yochanan, what we call in the Yerushalmi Rabbi Yonatan. And therefore, there is no real stage of the Gemara. We're talking about the Rabbanan, or at least it was a Havamin that it gets rejected. But in the end of the day, what we're doing is we start it. Basically, what the Gemara is saying is, at the end of the day, Tosefet Shvi'it is either D'oraita or Mutter. Those are the only two options, right? D'oraita or Mutter, right? The Havamina was, it's also D'oraita. And the Maskana is, we don't read the Pasuk that way, and therefore it's Mutar. There's no such thing. Zil.
We go through three opinions without mentioning any name.
Correct. Right? Four opinions. The fourth one has a name. The first three don't. Right? Great. Yes, welcome to Yerushalmi. That is true. Right? However, but then what's the second possibility, he says? What's the second possibility? The exact opposite, which is, yeah, Ruchaim Kanievsky's next possibility is the after Yerushalmi Lo Parach Lasfir Leizigam B'tchila Lasfir Zerushimurahi. Alternatively, he says, aha, no, Samchu means exactly what you think it means. It's Darabanan, and guess what the Yerushalmi's Kiddush is? That even Rabbi Kiva thought it was Darabanan. Boom! What's the problem with thinking even Rabbi Kiva thinks it's Darabanan? Then you need Chachma Uv'Minyan, and how the heck do you get out of it? Right? Right? Because everybody agrees that by Derabanan, what do you need? Gadolim v'chacham v'minyan. Right? So Rechaim Gadievsky has two possible reads of this Gemara. One possibility is that some clue here doesn't mean Derabanan at all. It means a straight drasha. And what the way you have to read the Gemara is that at first, right, we have the Rabbi Kiva-esque drasha that it's Asher Mida Araita. Then we say we got rid of it. The Gemara says, how do you get rid of it? Don't you chacham v'minyan? Answer. That would be true if it was the Rabbanan. But this is a machloket on how to understand. The Oraita, and that you don't need. Chacham v'minyan, right? That's Kobi. Right, Kobi is Reb Chaim Kanievsky's first shita. But then Reb Chaim Kanievsky says there's another radical way of reading the Yerushalmi, and that is... One second. What's the other radical way of reading the Yerushalmi? The Rabbi Akiva, or the Rabbi Akiva-esque position in the Yerushalmi is... And Asmachta and Rabbi Kiva, no one ever believed that those seven shviit in any way, shape, or form was d'oraita. That never happened. Lo yidu Rami Olam, right? There was never such a position. Everyone always thought it was d'rabbanan, right? And what's the problem he's left with?
How
did they get rid of it? Because everybody agrees that you need to be gadol v'medu v'chacham v'minyan to uproot a d'rabbanan. And maybe they were. I don't know. Yeah, both of them have problems in Echanami, right? The latter one is weird because it leaves you with the problem of Chacham v'Minyan, and it assumes that all this work I'm stuck in was all fake, right? Which is not crazy. I mean, that does happen, right?
Are there other words for saying that they're learning out from a pipe like this?
There are, yes. Fine, that's the problem with the first possibility.
Yes.
Good. That's what I'm saying. Whew. But let's say you don't want to do that. Let's say you're not comfortable with Rechaim Kanievsky. Either one. Is there a third option? Because Rechaim Kanievsky gives you the two options, which is either it's d'oraita, or throughout, or it's d'rabbanan throughout. Right? Right? Well, he doesn't give you that option. Right? But that's because Rav Chaim Kanievsky assumes that d'oraita and d'rabbanan are a binary, right? It's either or. But there's a fancy possibility, which is Rabbi Sachar Tamar, in the L.A. Tamar, which is one of a very modern work on Yerushalmi. We have it here in the base. And he says, you don't understand, the Yerushalmi is saying something much more radical than you ever imagined. The Yerushalmi is saying something much more radical than you ever imagined. That it is both Darabban and Darabban, right? Or it's neither. It's both but neither. Okay, so what?
Oh, I
understand. Oh, good. So how did we get to such a radical position? So here's where I have to introduce you to Asmachta, okay? Let's see if we can cover this today. It'd be a miracle if we can. Okay, good. Asmachta. What is an asmachta? So again, I'm not going to read everything inside, but I gave you a survey. What is an asmachta? What do Rove Rishonim think the word asmachta means? Yes?
It's a reliance. So,
which means?
It's something that we build up.
Meaning what? When we quote a pasuk as an asmachta, is the law in question biblical at all?
No.
Good.
Very good.
Good. That's a rove Rishonim to understand asmachta. Now they have variations on a theme. So for example, many of the Rishonim say, and again, they're not mutually exclusive. Many of the Rishonim, as I gave you a little subtitle, say that what is an asmachta? Zikaron. It's a siman lezikaron, or what we call in English a mnemonic. Something that helps you remember. Right? So for example, right, Tosfos says it very clearly, lu'ukme girsa lesimana, right, in number 3. Lu'ukme girsa lesimana, right, to make sure that your learning stays with you as a sign, as a mnemonic device. Right? Or the Rambam a little bit more explicitly in 2, v'chol inyan shein lo remez memikra v'lo asmachta, shalom lo mechan v'indot, be'ilu amrim halacha l'moshe mi'sinai. If it has no real support in the Torah, we call it halacha l'moshe mi'sinai. And then he says, and there are some things that are halacha moshmi Sinai, and we do attach it to a pasuk like shirim, right? Like all the different measurements in the Torah that if you guys did sukkah, or the beginning of sukkah, it says that we learn out all the shirim from Eretz Kitav Sa'arah, there's that, right? Where each pasuk, right? Each word there is something, right? Kitah is kadiyah chilat pras, right? Whether you have eight things within the amount of time that you have a chilat pras of wheat bread, right? And kizayit is obviously kizayit, because everything's kizayit, right? And kista'ora is etzim kista'ora, right? That a bone that is metame has to be the size of a barley kernel, whatever it's called. So then he says, so the Gemara asks, how can you say that shirim are halachal moshe misinai, that all the measurements in the Torah, halachal moshe misinai, don't we have a pasuk? And what does the Gemara answer? Asmachta be'alma. What is asmachta be'alma? It's just an asmachta. So what does the Rambam take that to mean? He says, Ela hismichum, he says, look, three lines from the bottom. He says, ve'ein lem shum yisod shil medum imenu bet achat meni nizok. There's no support from any of the exegetical principles, or the yugimu midah, from the Torah. Ve'ein lem remes v'chol ha-Torah. It's not actually hinted to. Ela hismichum l'pasuk ze ke'ein siman. Kidei shiish merum v'yiskerum. We attach it to a pasuk so you'll remember it. Ve'ein zem inyan ha-pasuk. It's not what the pasuk means at all. V'zeu inyan amram pras machto be'alma v'chol makam shinskai. That's what a smachto always means. It's a neman. It helps you remember. But it's completely derabot. Now, why is it? Someone tell me. Why do we bother reminding you? And the Kuzaris is the same thing, right? Why would we do this? Why is it? Why would we attach derabanan to psukim as a mnemonic? Why would you do that? But what, why is it so? Why do we care so much about making mnemonic devices? Why? Well, there's a very simple answer. Very good. That's a Reb David HaKochavi. Who's Reb David HaKochavi? I do not expect you to know this, except that I wrote it on the page. Who is Reb David HaKochavi? He was Haya Chacham mi Provence, the Mea Ha'albas, right? He's a 14th century Rishon from Provence. He wrote the book Sefer Habatin, which is a commentary on the Rambam. Okay. Yes, I remember one of my friends once being very indignant that people didn't know who Reb David HaKochavi is. What do you mean? Reb David HaKochavi was amongst the Gdolei Provence in the 14th century. I'm like, I mean, yes, he was. Okay. What? He's very rarely see him quoted. I mean, sometimes. But okay. So, Reb David HaKochavi and the Marcius also, who's Marcius? Chayes, C-H-A-J-E-S.
He is 19th century.
Very good. 19th century. He has the distinction of being the only commentary found in your standard Vilna Shas who had what?
A PhD.
Very good, Zach. Right? He is the only person in the standard Vilna Shas who has a PhD. He had a PhD in Talmudics or something, I don't know, something like that, right? Right, Dr. Zvi Hirsch Chayes. He also has the dissertation written about his life is also famous or infamous in yeshiva circles because it was written by Bruria Huttner, or Huttner's daughter, who wrote her PhD on Marv Seuss. She has a love-hate relationship with that PhD. What does she call him? A modern Moskiel, a traditional Moskiel. Something. She has a mixed approach to Marv Seuss. Anyway, but yeah, they say exactly what Josh said, which is why would you attach it to a pasuk? Because everything was learned by Peh. So the more mnemonic devices, the better. Good. Elsewhere, the Rambam says other things. For example, in Mor Nebuchim Gimel Mem Gimel, what does the Rambam say in Asmachlis? What's Derech Milisa? What's Milisa? You did it. You did this Mor Nebuchim. So Josh, tell me, what does he say in Gimel Mem Gimel? What?
Poetry.
Poetry. He says sometimes in Asmachta isn't even help you remember it. It's so that you can wrap up the Darabanan in beautiful poetry. Because when you attach it to the pasuk, it just sounds nicer. It's nice. There are aesthetic reasons to an Asmachta. Mordechai is like, really? You give me a pasuk for aesthetic reasons? Don't you remember? Who was at my goddess this year on Thursday? Well, remember, the Rav Avraham and Rambam says that rove drashot in the Torah, rove drashot are not real drashot. What are they? Beautiful words that are aesthetically pleasing. Right? So this is, right, this is something he shares with his father, that he appreciates beauty and attaching psukim to halachot or ethical things or anything is beautiful. It's a beautiful, poetic thing you can do. I'm sorry. Wow. But yes, he says it's beautiful. Not necessarily, but he's saying that we, even if they have a different primary meaning, we attach it for poetic reasons to something else. Okay?
Well, that would make sense, because...
Yes, of course it makes sense. It only doesn't make sense if you don't appreciate aesthetics.
No,
apparently Mordechai has no appreciation for aesthetics.
To,
or at least no appreciation for literary aesthetics. He's like, my only aesthetics is modern art and...
No.
Good, I figured I could elicit that reaction. Oh, I'm with you. I hate modern art. I hate modern art so much. I am a classicist on so many things. If I'm going to look at art, it should be like...
It should look good.
Right. It shouldn't be... In 12th grade, when I had to do, we had art class by, you know, New York law, right? I assume all of you in New York at some point took some, unless they've gotten rid of this requirement. But at some point, there was a requirement of one semester of art. Yeah, of course. And still same thing, pass-fail course, with your paper being you have to go to an actual museum, look at an actual picture, provide your pay stub that you actually went to the museum, and write a two-page 14-size font, double-spaced paper, pass-fail. And one of the full pages can be a picture of the art you're doing. This is how it was in my day, right? It wasn't exactly the most rigorous of courses. You just had to show up to class and then write a two-page paper on any art of your choice, and it was just pass-fail. And if you showed up to the museum, took a picture of the art, gave them your stub, and wrote a one-page thing on it, then you passed. So I did. I went with... Yaakov Miller and I went to MoMA, the Museum of Modern Art. I walked in, and as I walk into one of the wings, I see the picture that obviously inspired me to write a deep, profound thing, which was a blue piece of paper with white letters cut out of it that said, contact lens found at bottom of pool. And I decided that is clearly what I should write my paper on, and I did, where I wrote the very profound thesis that the artist came up with that idea while looking for his contact lens at the bottom of a pool and oxygen was being drained from his brain. And at that moment of his brain being drained from oxygen, then he came up with the idea that this was art. Though, I will be fair, my new favorite piece of modern art was the one that there was an article about last week. Did you see the newest scandal in modern art? It's great. An art museum paid some artist like tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars to produce modern art for them, and he sent them a blank canvas, and it's called Take the Money and Run, right? Which I thought was brilliant. I thought that was just wonderful. Kudos. I would go see that piece of art just to appreciate that artist, because that is basically how I feel about all of modern art. I'm with you, Mordechai. I mean, honestly, if you're going to go, I'm not like a big art person, but if you're going to go, so go and, I don't know, go see a Picasso, go see Monet, Manet, I mean, the Impressionists were brilliant. Go see Rembrandt, whose use of art, of light in his art is brilliant. Go see Sartre, right? Fine, but when I walk into the modern art part of the museum, I want to bang my head through a wall. Oh, my God.
And then there's going to be a sign under it, men banging head against the wall.
Yes.
$10,000.
Oh, don't joke. In MoMA, there is, in one of the sections, there is a piece of paper with dirt on it, which is man bouncing basketball on paper. I kid you not. This is like, there's all sorts of wonderful things at MoMA that, oh, my God. But the crazy thing is that people are really into it. They so understand it. I mean, I once went with, many years ago, I was in a summer kollel with Ray Clapper, and we did art in halacha for the summer. And as part of it, we took a trip to the Boston Museum of Fine Arts. And we went, and I'm, as you can tell, not exactly an art enthusiast. Of course, when I said this to someone, I mentioned to this that I'm not like a modern art enthusiast to one of the Rahm and Gush ones. And he's like, "You Philistine." Seriously, he meant it. And then he's like, "Well, I mean, I do think you should appreciate modern art," but he's like, "I'm not sure it's fair to call someone a Philistine who can quote Aristotle's chapter and verse." I'm like, okay, I mean, fine. Like, philosophy I can do. I just don't get modern art. It's just not.
No, there's no way anybody who actually makes all modern art. Like.
So anyway, so we went there to see,
oh my God, who are we going to see?
Rothko. Ever see a Rothko?
No.
Right? So either you don't understand Rothko at all and you're like me and you're a Philistine, or you are convinced that it is the most important thing. If you Google Rothko, you will see all of Rothko's paintings are the same. They are all two colors on a piece of paper, and that's it. It's just two halves of the paper with two colors. That's what they all look like. And they go for like hundreds. I kid you not, these go for millions of dollars. That's what Rothko is. Look. This is what it looks like. Like that. Those are millions, I tell you. Like, look, that's Rothko. Those are his paintings. Look, it's two, maybe three colors on the page. Look, Mordechai, that's it. Those are millions of dollars. Millions. But I have to admit, I went there, and I went with very smart people. Very, very smart people who I have a tremendous respect for, who are very serious, tell me that Chachamim and what... I told you that millions of dollars. And I went there with Rabbi Meir Sender, who I hope to bring in this year, because we've been trying. Right? Sender is one of these people. I love him so much. And he is so smart. He is a Talmud of the Rav, a big Talmud Chacham. He has a PhD from Tversky in Kabbalah from Harvard. He's a very smart person and a practicing mystic, right? And like, there are many things in life that he does that I do not understand, and he insists on, and like he explains it to me, but I'm not at that level. I'm not a mystic. I don't understand it, right? But I also don't understand modern art. And he tried to explain it to me, and I was standing there. And again, it could be I'm a Philistine, but he was telling me that the way you look at a Rothko is you look at the top color and you let it just hit you here. And then you look at the bottom color and you let you hit you here. And then the experiences mix together. And there are people, I kid you not, you go into any modern art museum and you go to a Rothko, there's always someone standing in front of the Rothko crying. And he will tell you that Rothko painted pure emotion. I don't understand this for the life of me. What? I don't know. It could be that I am not married to the possibility that I am not a Philistine. It is possible that I am an absolute barbarian. And that's why I don't understand it. Yes, $40 million. What's wrong? It's pure emotion. What emotions is that?
Blue.
No. One of those must be the emotion I feel when I'm reading this Yerushalmi. Confusion and baffle. Which one is it? I don't know. Pick one. I don't understand. I don't know.
Yes.
Guess what's on it.
What?
Guess what's on the
pavement. Orange and tan. It probably went for $10 million, $20 million? You see what happened is like 2 minutes ago Kobe was making fun of it and now Kobe's like, you know, I'm in for Rothko now. See, this is a problem. It's all it takes. It's brilliant.
Look, Arlington is a Mark Rothko painting committed in 1954.
Yes.
By which time he had been working in the color field
style
for quite a number
of years. Yes, okay, fine. Yeah, the point of all of this, Mordechai, was that people value aesthetics for the sake of aesthetics, and part of it, at least, yeah, of course he's Jewish. Of course he's Jewish. So Mordechai, right, but the point is that the Rambam thinks there's an intrinsic value to aesthetics, and therefore what's the problem, right? So what's the problem in a Hanami, right? There's no problem. Maybe sometimes we just like the aesthetics. Okay. So there are variations on a theme, okay? However, there are other possibilities, okay? And I see that we're not going to get to Rizakar Tamar today. That's fine. It's tomorrow. okay, this is a good release, release valve here, but... Yeah, that's fine. But I want to give you two other sheet code about Asmachta. This one will probably make you angry. It will not help us understand the Yerushalmi, but it will make you angry, and that's the Maharil. Maharil, sorry, I need to brace myself every time I read this Maharil. Okay, the Maharil, who is, I will just tell you, one of the most important poskim in all of Ashkenaz ever. And you know when the Rama quotes all Minhagi Ashkenaz? Like half the time it's from the Maharil. Maharil is literally one of the most important Ashkenazi poskim in the last 600 years. It's number seven. Number seven, right? So what we're about to read, you must understand, is from one of the most important Ashkenazi poskim who ever lived. Okay? So before you go crazy, what? So before you go crazy, just understand that this is, you know, from a very, very important person. He says, Kol heichadet marmid rabbanu cross machta be'alma. Every time you find something that says it's an asmachta, hachi perusho. This is what it means. Vadai takanta derabbanan hu. It is definitely only derabbanan. So far we like the Rambam. Just derabbanan. Then yatuva tu matulem smach mikra. And then they found a pasuk to hang their hat on. So far like the Rambam? Good. Visamchu divrehem alav. And why did they rely on the pasuk? Kidei lahachzikam. And they attached it to a pasuk for what purpose? To trick you into thinking it's d'oraita so you would take it seriously.
So why would the Gemara say that in the first place? The
because only experts are reading the Talmud. This is before Daf Yomi. The average Jew ain't reading the, right? It's not like nowadays where everybody is doing Daf Yomi. Like since the last Daf Yomi, it's like the Gansa Olam is doing Daf Yomi. All I see is everybody doing Daf Yomi now. It's unbelievable, right? Not just like the people you expect, but everybody is doing Daf Yomi. Right? Like, everybody is doing Daf Yomi. It's unreal. I mean, I'm a big fan of this. I mean, it's great. But, like, I promise you, no one ever imagined in a million years. Rebbeir Shapiro, when he started Daf Yomi, did not know what it would look like in this cycle. I mean, the number of interviews I've heard in the last few years, right? So, I was listening to an interview by Dara Horn. Dara Horn has started her Daf Yomi Chavruta. Dara Horn is, like, traditional conservative fiction writer. Excellent, by the way. She's great. She's amazing. She's so good. Like, her books are so fascinating, and her newest book is a nonfiction, which is also great, called People Love Dead Jews. So good. Gotta read it. So much fun. And her new podcast, which is all the stories that didn't make into it, unbelievably fascinating, about the Jewish state they set up in Manchuria. I mean, it's like, this is really cool stuff. So she was talking about how she started Daf Yomi, right? There's an economist at Princeton who's I don't know if she's Orthodox or she's just Jewish, and she started Daf Yomi, but I was listening to an interview by her with Ari Lam where she said she started learning with some totally unaffiliated person who happened to sit next to her on the plane at the beginning of Daf Yomi and became enthralled with it and still doing Daf Yomi. And like since the last Daf Yomi where they did Hadron, right, the women's Siyum on Daf Yomi, so all these women who never like learned Gemara in their life are doing Daf Yomi. My mother-in-law started learning Daf Yomi. Like now everybody I know is doing Daf Yomi. It's amazing. And everyone I don't know is doing Daf Yomi also. It's like the whole world is doing Daf Yomi. It's great. But before that, if you said something to Smash Obama, no one ever read that except for the people who understood Gemara.
No, but what does she say? It's like almost as strong. Why can they just hit
so much
when they can? Why does it
hit Daraita? So, okay. So what does Maril say? Maril says that Asmachta is just a Dirabanan, but they didn't attach, they attached the Pasuk to trick you. So you would take it seriously. So you think it's Daraita? Is this a problematic idea? Oh, it's very problematic. And arguably, it's what the Rambam had something else, which he called this, I think. And you know what it was? It wasn't a smachta. You know what it was?
I know a lot.
A baltosif. An isher d'oraita of baltosif. Because what does the Rambam say baltosif is? What does the Rambam say is what? Right, and when, so the Rambam says, it's adding to the Torah. So the Rambam has a problem. What do you mean you're not allowed to add to the Torah? The rabbis add to the Torah all the time. And what's his answer?
When they create a new
Torah. No. Yes. If they make a Darabbanan law and say, we're making a new law, but by the way, it's rabbinic, then what is that called? A rabbinic law. If they make a rabbinic law and call it Daraita, what do we call that? Baltosif. right? So the Maharil's Asmachta approaches the Rambam's violation of Paltosif very closely. Fine. You want to, you can, I said, it approaches the Rambam's Baal Tosef. I gave you the Rambam here if you're interested in number 8, right? And as well as a seeming earlier version of this in Avot Rabbi Natan. Now, all of this does not help us, because all of this assumes that Asmachta, as disturbing as the Maharil might be, right, at this point, still, all it means is Derabbanan, right? So we haven't changed anything. The outlier who thinks that Asmachta is Nish Derabonon, Nish Deoraisa, right? And this is what we'll see tomorrow, is the Ritva. Okay? So what we're going to do tomorrow, and this, I think, is the last major topic I want to do in this Yerushalmi, which is good, because what's today, Wednesday? Good! So we might actually mostly finish the Yerushalmi this week, or at least we'll finish all the main issues I want to cover in this Yerushalmi, right? The Ritva says, guess what? Asmachta isn't Daraita, but it's not Derabanan either. So what's not Daraita, not Derabanan?
Was it less than Derabanan?
Nope. 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 It's an Asmachta. An Asmachta is something else. And what is it? Well, that's what you're going to see, because the Ritva is going to tell you, guess what? An Asmachta is magic. Should I give you the short version so you know what you're looking for in the Ritva? Fine. Here's what I want you to do tomorrow. The Ritva, in a nutshell, but we'll have to read it inside tomorrow so you believe me, says that an Asmachta is a Derabanan that God programmed into the Torah with the intention that the rabbis would decree it, but didn't make them decree it. And therefore, it has the status of the Derabanan, which if they choose to decree it, they're actually manifesting what God wanted, but God said, listen, some things I tell you you have to do, and sometimes I tell you that things are, you know, optional if you so choose. It's an optional deoraita. That's what it is. It's an optional deoraita, which therefore finds it.
How can they cancel once they already made it?
Oh, and therefore, with the already radical shita of the Ritva, which I want you to read inside because you don't believe me, this is where you can discover that Rabbi Yisachar Tamar says, aha, you mean an asmachta is not a derabanan or a deoraita? It's something where God programmed in options into the Torah? Well, what happens if he programs in two opposite options that are both quasi-daraita? What happens? And he says, aha, that is our Gemara. Our Gemara is the weirdest possible construct where God gave two possible quasi-daraitas. Good luck figuring this one out inside tomorrow. Read the Ritva and read Rabbi Sakhar Tamar, and with that, we will have finished all the exciting issues in the Yerushalmi, and we'll polish it off, but both the Ritva and Rabbi Sakhar Tamar's amazing expansion of the Ritva are amongst the most fascinating conceptual moves that I have ever heard in my entire life. When I gave this in this series in Toronto, this was everybody's favorite shiur, was, whoa, that's cool, and everyone's first answer, which is there any other example of this, and I'm like, I have no idea what to tell you. It is a brilliant piece of Rabbi Sakhar Tamar. So that's what you read it in tomorrow. And read it tomorrow. Oh yes. Oh, it is beautiful. It is just so beautiful and so shocking at the same time. It's wonderful.